Well, we're going to overview our overview. We've been looking at this for several months now, and so I want to catch you up to speed of where we are and why. First of all, we have seen that it is reasonable to believe that the Bible is God's revelation to man. That was one of our first sermons in this. And any of these first points we're going to make, the tapes are available. If you want the sermon notes, we've got those available for you too. It's reasonable to believe the Bible is God's revelation of himself and his will to man. And therefore, we should study it and know what's in it so we can follow it. We need to follow God. We also found that God is the omniscient, omnipotent creator, and he did it just the way he said, in 6 days. Just 6 days. That is the nature of God. If your God cannot make everything in 6 days, you have a very weak God. I want the one that does it the way he says it. That's the one I follow. You follow somebody else, that's not the God I've got. We found also is that evolution and Genesis are not compatible. You can't make them compatible. One or the other is true, not both. They're completely opposed to each other. We have found that evolution is not a science. It is a philosophical system. It has presented a model for science origins, but the data that you actually go out and gather in the real world around us doesn't fit their model. It's not true. We've seen the physical realities are that evolution is in direct contradiction to the laws of physics, especially the second law of thermodynamics. Things go from order to disorder, high energy to low energy, not the other way around as demanded by evolution. We have seen that the age of the earth is not billions, it's not millions, it's thousands of years old. That is demonstrated by science. To say it's older than that is philosophy, not science. We found that the geologic column exists only in one place, in your textbook. It doesn't exist in the real world, and there are people who, well, I should say it also exists in the minds of men who demand that what they go out and see is fitted into it, even when what they're looking at, the geologic formations, are contradictory to it. But so they are. But we found in 2 Peter that we should expect that. Men will purposely ignore the evidence around them. We also have found that the fossil record does not document even a single major morphological change from one animal type to another, much less any type of evolutionary tree. It is, as Bonnour, former director of the National Center of Scientific Research in France, has said, my favorite quote, evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has done helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless, unquote. Now, if you think that's a little strong in evolution, you should get the tapes and find out how much stronger I am against it. It isn't true. That's my background, is science. I became a pastor after gaining my degrees in science. It's not true. And I'd be happy to talk to anybody about any aspect of it. Also, or come tonight. You can ask any question you want, either on creation, the creation-evolution debate, or we're going to also talk about Noah's flood, anything on that, and we'll be happy to try and answer your questions for you this evening at 6 o'clock. The third thing we found is that God created man in his own image, and that means that man has certain characteristics. We have personhood. That means we're rational, we can think, we're emotional, we can feel psychically, and we're volitional. We have the ability to choose. And these immaterial aspects that God has given to us separate us from the animals. In addition, God made man, Adam and Eve, when he fashioned them, he gave them also his moral attributes and perfection, holiness and righteousness and love and joy and peace and goodness and gentleness, kindness, self-control, all these things Adam and Eve have in perfection. God then fashioned Eve from one of Adam's ribs. He established marriage. Man was made to be God's regent on earth by subduing it and ruling over it. Fourth, we have found that though God placed Adam and Eve in a perfect environment for them, the Garden of Eden, they instead succumbed to Satan's lies concerning God and fell into sin. They rebelled, they disobeyed the only prohibition they had, don't eat from the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. They refused to do that, they did it anyways, and they fell into sin. Now, I should emphasize right here at this point, it wasn't the fruit of the tree that was somehow magical. It was the disobedience that brought the knowledge of evil by experience. Anything God would have prohibited would have been the same thing. Don't go out of the garden, don't do this, don't anything. If they had violated it, they now would have had the knowledge of sin the knowledge of evil by experience and plunge into sin. By having something they weren't supposed to do, it gave them a choice. They were volitional. They had a choice. They chose wrong. And because they did choose wrong, it broke their relationship with God. Remember that death is separation. Spiritual death happened that day. Their relationship with God was broken. They began the process of physical death. It had not been there before. And it brought curses upon them and the world. And we still have to deal with that today. And yet, in the midst of those curses, there was the hope given. Genesis 3:15. There would be one who was going to come, the seed of the woman that would bruise the serpent's head. From that point on, through the rest of Scripture, we're looking for the Redeemer. In the Old Testament, we're looking forward to it. In the New Testament, we're looking back on the Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Promised from the beginning, in the midst of a curse, God gave hope. Well, sin reigned in the generations that followed. The average length of life was 912 years prior to the flood. But if you notice that each of these lines, except Noah, who lived past the flood, ends. Death reigned. Long lives, but they died. In addition, we find that by the time of Noah, not only had Cain murdered Abel, Lamech was also a murderer, but by the time of Noah, the people were in utter evil. Every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually, so much so that God set out to destroy man and all the animals by a worldwide flood. But Noah, a descendant of Adam through the line of Seth, found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Through him, that promise of redemption was carried. And Noah was faithful to do everything that God told him to do. He built the ark just like he was commanded. He placed the animals in there just like he was commanded. And the ark was the only means by which Noah, his family, and representatives of all the animal kinds survived the flood. Noah was faithful. But when they got out of the ark, it was a different world. It wasn't the same world they had lived in. Several things were of major change. We talked about this last week or 2 weeks ago. One of them was the fact that the relationship between man and animals had changed. Prior to this, there was not a fear that animals had of man, but now there would be a fear. Prior to this, animals were not supposed to be part of man's diet. Now animals were allowed to be part of man's diet. We find that there was the protective layer that had been provided by the water that had been above the heavens. It's gone, and the length of life plummets dramatically. Okay, there's Noah, and here's Shem way over here, and this is simply an exponential line of how fast the length of life dropped after the flood. Not many generations. You go from 950 down to 147, and then it plummeted after that. So by the time of Moses, it was 70 years, or if by strength, 80 years. How rapidly things had changed. But one thing had not changed, and that was man's bent toward sin. The bulk of humanity followed Nimrod's rebellion. They refused to disperse over the earth and populate it as God has commanded. Instead, they built a city, Babel, and then built a tower that reached up to heaven. It was actually part of a false religious system. God intervened, he infused the languages, and he spread them out all over the earth. And this was the Table of Nations, and where the children of Noah and their descendants spread out. This is a little simplistic one. We saw last week kind of where more of these went, but they spread out all over the world. God intervened. But we ended the study last week with a genealogy that traced the line of hope through Noah and Shem down to Abram, and we pick up the story today in Genesis chapter 12. And we know of Abram from the end of chapter 11 a few things. First, he is one of three sons of Terah. We know that he lived in Ur of the Chaldees, and that his brother Haran had died there in Ur of Chaldees. And this is his genealogy there listed there in Genesis chapter 11. Now, sometime after Haran died, Terah, along with Abram and Abram's wife Sarai, and his grandson Lot, moved up to Haran. Now, they were on their way to Canaan, but they only got that far. They were following the Fertile Crescent, and that's where Terah died at 205 years old. And we pick up the story there in Genesis chapter 12. If you're not there already, please turn there. Genesis chapter 12. In the first couple of verses, we find, we often call this the Abrahamic covenant. And there's a fourfold promise that's within it. It says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house, the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Now this is the core, again, of the Abrahamic covenant. First, Abraham and his descendants are going to receive a particular land from God. The exact borders of that will be explained later on. Chapter 15 will give you all the borders. Second is God is going to make of Abraham a great nation. Now that's going to take the Lord's intervention. The name Abram, now it's not Abraham yet, it's simply Abram, means exalted father. Now this is kind of rough. He's 75 years old. You introduce, you know, "What's your name?" "My name's Abram." "Oh, how many kids you got?" None. "Oh, how old's your wife?" "You know, it's about the same age. A little younger." They're getting past the age of childbearing. It's going to take God's intervention. But God says, you're going to become a great nation. Third, God is going to bless all the families of the earth through Abram. He is going to be the one through whom the promised Redeemer is going to come. And finally, God is going to be Abraham's protector. He's going to bless those who bless him, curse those who curse them. Later on, we're going to find God specifically saying things like he is Abraham's shield. So four things are part of this. Now, it's crucial to understand what God is doing here. Man was created for the purpose of bringing God glory by being God's representative on earth, the one who would rule in his stead, if you will, his regent. He would subdue and then rule over all creation on earth. That was his purpose. But when man sinned, he lost his ability to do this properly. Satan became the usurper and is called even the God of this age, the God of this world. He has taken that over. He has usurped man's position. Now, God's not through with man by any means. He had a plan. He has a purpose. Man was to still proclaim God to all creation while waiting for the time when God would redeem man and restore him to that proper place for which he was created from the beginning. We are in the middle of that. Well, actually, probably towards the end of it, but we're in that. We are waiting for that final redemption when man will be restored to his proper place and do what God had originally created him for. The problem was that man left to himself, to individual conscience, wasn't going to follow God. You had Adam and Eve. Cain did worse. Lamech did worse, to the point the thoughts, the intents of their hearts were only evil continually. Man left his individual conscience isn't going to follow God. The early human governments that were formed should have helped the situation. We all do better when there are rules given to us. Where there are no rules, we as humans don't do what we should do, even when it's good for us. Okay? Even when it comes to something simple like a diet. Right? We have choices. We have the junk food. We got the healthy food. What do we go for? Well, we start with the healthy food. It's good for us. We should do this. And pretty soon we're over here to the junk food and increasing in our girth. Why? That's our bent. Human government is supposed to set up laws to keep you from the stuff that's harmful. But instead, the early human governments didn't do that. They actually aggravated the situation, as we saw with the case of Nimrod. Helped people in the rebellion against God. But all the way through, we've seen so far, God has a remnant. He has a line through which hope is continually being given. There is this one or that one, an individual here, an individual there. In fact, we've seen they're coming in a line of descendants who will follow God. And that's where Abraham fits. Abraham is God's chosen person who is now going to be the one who is going to represent God and his descendants afterward to proclaim the glories of God to all the rest of creation. That was his very purpose. He and his descendants to eventually become a nation of priests. Mediators is what a priest is, who will proclaim God to the people and petition God on behalf of the people. That was his purpose. And so there are certain characteristics we find in Abraham. Now understand that these characteristics are there, but that's not why God chose him. He has these characteristics, so it was a good choice, but God chose him simply because God chose him. The Old Testament tells us that later on. It wasn't because of anything about them, except that he did. God always has his remnant. Someone who's going to proclaim him, regardless of what anybody else is doing. Abraham is the man. And we've traced that through the genealogies. Now we find in verses 4 through 9 that Abraham does do what God told him to do. He took his wife, Sarai, which means princess, along with his nephew Lot, and he travels all the way from Haran down south into the land of Canaan as far as a place called Shechem. And it was there that the Lord again appeared to Abraham and said to him, "To your descendants I will give this land." So now the land's being defined a little more clearly. That's verse 7. Abraham then built an altar there and then traveled to a place a little farther south between Bethel and Ai. He pitched his tent there and built another altar to the Lord. And then sometime later he went down farther south to Negev, the desert region south of, in the southern part of modern Israel. In verses 10 through 20, we find about some of Abraham's character flaws. Abraham wasn't perfect. See, one reason we know the Bible was not written by men is men will avoid putting in their failures. We don't like doing that. You read someone's autobiography and they don't talk a lot about their failures. They talk about the good things they did. The Bible exposes it all. Abraham had character flaws. And we find it here. Now, verse 10 says, "Now there was a famine in the land, so Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, 'See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman, and it will come about when the Egyptians see you that they will say, "This is his wife," and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and that I may live on account of you." It came about when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. Remember, she is not young at this point either. She is an elderly lady. It's something I think all you ladies would like. I hope I look that good when I'm in my 80s. Well, she did. Pharaoh's official saw her, praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. Therefore, he treated Abram well for her sake, gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Then Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife, take her and go." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away, and his wife and all that belonged to him. Now we'll end up seeing this same behavior later on in Abram's life, and again in his son Isaac. Though Abram is known for his faith, his trust in the Lord, there were times when his faith was lacking. This is one of them. He was afraid the Egyptians might kill him in order to take Sarai from him. He was afraid. He was fearful. And that was despite the fact God had already promised that he would become a great nation. How could he become a great nation if he gets killed? God would not be true to his promise then, would he? So he already had an assurance there, but he was afraid and acted on that fear. Now we often do the same thing, don't we? We have God's promises. We know what they are. Do we follow them? Sometimes we allow our fears to take over. And instead of doing and acting the way God would want us, we let our fears control us. And it's wrong. And yet we find that Abraham would grow in his faith throughout his life. That is what is to mark us as Christians. It's not that we're perfect. We're not. If you think you're perfect, take a harder look in the mirror or ask your spouse. If your spouse is not going to tell you the truth, ask your kids. They will tell you. You are not perfect. Okay? But you should be growing in your faith, coming to understand, as time goes on, better who God is and trust Him more. And as you trust Him more, your life will follow suit. So it's a growing faith that Abraham has as well. I think that's important for us to know, because sometimes we look at these Bible characters and we think that what they were at their end of their life is how they always were. and therefore they're not real examples for us. That's not true. They were no different than you or I. Nothing different about them. They had to grow in faith as well. They had weaknesses. Abraham shows that. His faith will grow throughout his life. But we find out something else here. God is gracious even when we fail. You've all seen that? He is gracious even when we fail. And even here we find that though Abram has a lack of faith, God blesses him anyway. And he returns to Egypt, from Egypt, back up to the Negev, and then finally up to Bethel and Ai as a wealthy man from all the things that Pharaoh had given to him. God blessed him anyways. It's not because of anything in Abraham, then, is it? Simply because God chose to do so. And that's the nature of our God. It's not dependent on us. It's dependent on Him and His character. That's why it's so important to know Him and His character, because that's what our trust has to be in. In Genesis chapter 13, we find that the great wealth that Abram and his nephew Lot have lead to some problems. Because the land could no longer sustain both of them living in the same area, they had too many flocks, too many herds, and the herdsmen were now in contention with each other. So Abram took Lot up to a ridge. He's got a plan. I can eliminate this problem. He takes Lot up to a ridge. It's overlooking the Jordan Valley. And he gives Lot the choice. This is treating Lot as a favored son. You choose whatever you would like. You go choose that land, I'll go this way. You choose this land, I'll go this way. We don't need to have contention between us. No strife. Now, perhaps this is in part because he doesn't want to have a bad witness in front of the Canaanite and the Perizzite that are in the land at that time. But regardless, it's an act of great generosity on Abram's part. Here we already see an increasing faith in Abraham, because God had promised he would have a great name, he'd have a nation, he'd have land. He's trusting God. God, you'll provide for me. Lot can take whatever he wants. I know you'll do what's right. Increasing faith on Abram's part. Now, the Jordan Valley, even today, still appears very well watered, the northern section of it, until you get down the Dead Sea, and then it's pretty desolate. But the rest looks well watered, even better back then before Sodom and Gomorrah was overthrown. Now, if you were a herdsman and you had your choice, hey, here's some hill country, or wow, here's a valley, it's well watered, there's green grass, what would you choose if you're selfish? You'd do the same thing Lot did. Lot chose and went down into the Jordan Valley, and then it says that he ended up going down into the area near Sodom and put his tent near Sodom. Now, at this point, this was still a lush area. Okay, not like it is now. It was a lush area, good place to be. But for whatever reason, that's where he goes. And even then, Genesis 13:13 says, describes the men of that place, were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. Probably not the best place to get near, but that's where he went. Now, meanwhile, the Lord then appears to Abram and tells him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth. I will give it to you. And then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So he moves a little farther south, but when he's on this ridge, he looks north, south, east, and west, and God says, everything you see belongs to you. This is the land I'm giving you. So it's further defined exactly what land. And notice it says forever. It's not conditional. Until something, it is yours forever to you and your descendants. Well, in chapter 14, we find something else about Abraham's character as he responds to a problem that Lot got into. Here we find there's a war, and Lot is taken captive, and Abram has to rescue him. The kings in the Tigris and Euphrates regions, Persia, Babylon, that section in here of Mesopotamia, had formed a confederacy, and out of that, they said, a good way to benefit ourselves is to subjugate other people. And so they did. They formed a confederacy, they went out and they conquered other peoples, and those people then had to pay tribute to them. Now, one of the areas that they conquered was that lower area of the Jordan Valley. In the scriptures there, it's called the Valley of Siddim, Valley of Salt. they conquered it. But after 12 years of subjugation, the kings in the lower Jordan Valley rebelled, resulting in Chedorlaomer and the kings of the Tigris-Euphrates area preparing for war, and then the 14th year, they came back down and started conquering. The Eastern Alliance came down, they conquered the areas to the north, the east, and the west, and then came up and conquered the Sodom and Gomorrah, that lower area of the Valley of Siddim again. Now perhaps that was to protect their flanks, perhaps it was to prevent any way of escape, but they conquered it. Many of them fell, there were tar pits in the area, many fell in that area, were killed there. A few escaped to the hills. Everything else was taken captive and is being hauled back to Mesopotamia. And among those are Lot. Partially because at this point, the scripture says Lot was living in Sodom. Not nearby, not with his tent out in the outskirts. He's now in Sodom for whatever reason. He is now part of the plunder. Now, one of the survivors of the battle made it to Abram and told him what had occurred. Now, this is the first place there in verse 13. Abram is called the Hebrew. The Hebrew. The word itself means one from beyond. He was from another place. He had come and was now living there. It also may originate from his ancestor, his forefather, Eber. But here is the first word, or first time the term Hebrew is used, and it's Abram. Now, Abram had an alliance with some of the Amorites that were living nearby, and together they pursue, and they catch up at Dan, which is just south of Mount Hermon. Actually, it's at its at the foothills leading up to Mount Hermon. Now, Abram was able to muster a force out of his own servants of 318 men. Now, that's a pretty good-sized force. And you can see he doesn't have his own kids. These are just his servants. Now, if his allies had at least that many men, that sounds pretty good because he'd have four times that many. But remember, they're pursuing a confederation of five kings. So no matter what, they're badly outnumbered. Abraham has to trust God in the midst of this. Otherwise, this is a foolish thing to be going and doing. Well, Abraham employs very good military strategy. It's a surprise attack at night with a divided force. The enemy is going to be unprepared for it. They're not going to be able to assess the size of the force that's actually attacking it. But even so, to do this requires Abraham to trust God. He's going to have to enable him because there's no way that small force could take on five kings. Not only that, but we've got to remember the five kings, their forces are now battle-hardened. They've been through quite a few battles already capturing all these areas. Abraham's men, well, yeah, they've been fighting wild animals, but that'd be about it. It's not the same thing. Well, Abram defeats them. He chases them north of Damascus, and then he brings back all the spoil, all those captured, including Lot. Now, on the way back, verses 17 through 24 tell us that Abram is met in the valley of Sheveh, that is adjacent to what is now Jerusalem, probably the Valley of Kittim, by two men. One is the king of Salem, or I should say the new king of Salem. The old king was killed in the war, but they got another king. And Melchizedek. Melchizedek is the king of Salem. We know it as Jerusalem. Now, Melchizedek is also a priest of the Most High God, which is the same God that Abram serves. And the picture here is for two reasons. One, it depicts Abram and Melchizedek meeting. And two, it's to increase your appreciation of art. If you can see that far to see what's up there. But this is simply a depiction of that. Now, Melchizedek comes out and he brings wine and bread to Abram. Abram, in turn, gives Melchizedek a tenth of all the spoils. Hebrews 7 refers to this very action as demonstrating that the priesthood of Melchizedek was superior to the Aaronic line, which is down the road. Okay? It's superior. Now, some suggest things about Melchizedek. Who was he? We don't know exactly. It's been suggested he was a Christophany, an Old Testament appearance of Christ of some sort. But it's interesting, the ancient Jewish tradition was that this was Shem. And we showed you the timelines earlier of how long they lived. Shem actually lived 35 years longer than Abraham. He was still alive when Abraham died. So ancient Jewish tradition was that this was Shem. Well, Melchizedek blessed Abram and God Most High, El Elyon, who is credited with the victory. Not Abraham. El Elyon is credited with the victory. Well, the king of Sodom recognized the spoils belonged to Abram and tells Abram, keep those, just return the people to me so you know we can go back to our homes. However, Abram does not want the spoil because he had set out only to rescue Lot. That was his purpose. And we find out in the text here that he had sworn to the Lord not to gain for himself or allow the possibility the king of Sodom could somehow claim that Abram became rich because of all these spoils. So Abram returned all the spoil except for what was eaten by the troops and the share that belonged to his allies, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Now Abram's actions here throughout this chapter demonstrate a man that has grown in his faith. He has learned to trust God in situations that were very dangerous, could have been, should have been, a cause of fear. They also demonstrate a man who has understood that it is more important for God to gain glory than gain it for himself. God said He'd make His name great. He will let God take care of that now. He's going to trust God. He's growing in His trust, His faith in Him. They also find here that He gives a tenth of the spoil to Melchizedek. It's a part of His worship of God. Now let me quickly add here, there was no command, there was no demand, there was no compulsion for Abram to do this. The tithe was given completely voluntarily. Paul comments in 2 Corinthians 9 that tells us that's still the way the Lord wants us to give to Him. It is an act of worship, not a compulsion, not a necessity. It's because you place it in your own heart that this is what I do in a response of worship to my God. That's still how we're to give. That's why we have a faith box and we don't pass a plate. We don't want you to be compelled. We want it to be your act of worship, period. And I'll add this. The text in 2 Corinthians 9 says to do it cheerfully. If you can't give cheerfully, don't give. Get your heart right, then give, because it's worship. Abram's the example of that as well. Well, in chapter 15, we find that God restates and expands His covenant with Abram. In verse 1, God tells Abram in a vision, do not fear. Abram, I am your shield to you. Your reward will be very great. And God gave him two reasons not to fear. First, the Lord would be his shield, his protector, proved in the recent battle. But second, the Lord is going to give him a great reward. But Abram has a concern. Who's my heir? Now, the Lord's earlier promise included him being a great nation. Was this supposed to be Eliezer? And the answer is no. Verses 4 and 5. This man, Eliezer, will not be your heir, but the one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. He took him outside and said, now look to the heavens and count the stars if you were able to count them. He said, so shall be your descendants. It would not be Eliezer. It would be a child from his own body, and his descendants would be as numerous as the stars. That's quite a promise. It's an expansion on what he'd already said before. And then Genesis 15, verse 6, one of the key passages of all Scripture. It says, then he, referring to Abram, then he believed in the Lord, and he, referring to God, reckoned it to him as righteousness. What a precious promise. That particular verse is referenced in Romans 4, 3, 6, 9, 20 through 25, Galatians 3, 6 through 14, Hebrews 11, 8, and James 2, 23. All referring back to this as the nature of faith that we are to have in our own time. Now, the Lord did not grant righteousness to Abraham because of any work Abram had done. It was simply because he believed in the Lord. In other words, he believed in the Lord and he trusted the Lord to fulfill all the promises God had made. And that belief, that trust, that faith was reckoned or counted by God to Abraham as righteousness. It is this faith in God that resulted in Abraham being called the friend of God in James 2:23. It's because of that, he says, this is the friend of God. Same thing can be true for us. If that is our faith, we should be known as friends of God. Faith in the Lord and His promises is still the only basis by which a man can be made righteous before God. Man cannot cleanse himself from his sin. He can't do it. There's no way you can do it. There's no means by which you can cleanse yourself. Your sin is a stain on you that you can't get rid of. Man has no means by which he can put himself in a position in which God must accept him. You do all these good works and see, now God, you've got to accept me. All your works are as filthy rags before God that do nothing for him. He's completely autonomous. He doesn't need you or me. So you can't earn it in any way. You can't earn even God's favor. See, I did some good things. You should like me now, God. See, I'm really trying. That doesn't do anything for God. God cleanses, accepts, and grants his favor only on the basis of the conditions he has established. And the condition he has established is belief in him. That's it. Do you believe him? Now understand, though, that belief, trust, and faith are simply facets of the same thing. They're not separate ideas. They're simply facets of the same basic premise. Belief is not, it is not intellectual assent. That's our biggest problem in our nation. We got this idea we believe something. We intellectually acknowledge it and think that's belief. That's not belief. That's intellectual assent. What you believe in, you place your faith in. What you place your faith in, you trust. James 2:20 through 26 points out that acting upon your stated belief is simply the fruit that proves the reality of your stated faith. If we take it in reverse, we put it this way. Claiming to believe and then failing to act upon what you say you believe only demonstrates your claim of belief is false. You have a false faith. You don't believe what you're saying. You're lying. You're lying to yourself. What you believe is going to result in what you do. It's a lot easier to watch someone, see what they're doing, and then tell them, this is what you believe because this is what you're doing. Now, again, it doesn't mean we're not going to have inconsistencies there because we should be growing in our faith. And we'll say, I know I failed in that, like Abraham did, but I know where I want to go. I know what I do believe, and I failed. I believed a lie. I don't want to believe a lie. I want to believe the truth. God reckoned Abraham to be righteous simply on the basis that Abraham believed God. And what specifically? Well, the context here is that he believed that God would grant him an heir from his own body in which and through whom all these promises are going to be fulfilled. I believe you, God. It's going to happen. Now, in verse 7, God restates the promises concerning the land. He says, I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. And Abram responds, O Lord God, how may I know that I shall possess it? Now, this is not suggestive of a disbelief in God's promise. It's seeking an assurance. Abram still does not have any children, and he's looking for some confirmation of this promise. And God responds by having Abram prepare for a covenant ritual. Verse 9, So he said to him, Bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old female goat, and a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him. He cut them in two. He laid each half opposite each other, but he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses. Abraham would drive them away. Now, all that seems really strange to us. When we're going to have a covenant made, or we call it contract, when we're going to drop a contract, we get lawyers together, and they have a big conference, and they put things in all these legal terms of here's your obligations, here's your responsibilities, and here's what happens if you don't fulfill your responsibilities, and we pay them a lot of money for writing things we don't understand. So if something happens, we can go to court, and then Jim Pagonis can decide what was really in here or not. It gets really confusing, but we pay lawyers to do all that now, right? So saying is, I'm going to make a contract to you is, hey, go get some animals, and we're going to cut them in half and put a piece over here and a piece over here. Like, what is that? Do you realize our term cut a covenant or cut a contract comes from this? That's where it comes from. Now, the idea was is you made a contract with someone, a covenant with someone. You've stated, you know, I want you to do this. Okay, I'll do this, and in turn I'll get this. Is I cut these animals half here, half there, and both people would then walk between the animals. Now, this is getting really weird, right? It's a little gruesome, too. The idea was, is when you walk through between these animals, you're stating, if I do not keep my end of the contract, that's what's supposed to happen to me. You cut me in half. Ooh, it's kind of serious. Can you imagine what it would be like today if when we made contracts, we did something like this and took them that seriously? Why, there'd be no lawyers. Because no one would dare break a contract. Because I don't want to die. It was a very serious thing. But that's actually what's going on here. Abram gets all the pieces together. They're there. It's ready. And he's waiting for the Lord to come. Meanwhile, he's driving off the birds of prey that are coming to eat on the carcasses. Well, that occurs in verse 12. It says, "Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I'll also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. Then the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." So Abraham falls into deep sleep, and God reveals what is going to happen 200 years from now. Your descendants are going to end up in a foreign country, eventually going to be enslaved. They're going to stay there for 400 years before they're removed out of that oppression and come back to this very land to inherit it. So it's all done beforehand. Why? A very simple thing. The wickedness of the Amorites, or part of the Canaanites, is not total yet. They have not gotten so bad yet that God is going to destroy them. That will be in the future. And indeed, that was not the case at that point, because some of Abram's friends, his neighbors, were Amorites. But in the future, they would be that wicked. Now remember, the purpose of Genesis is being written by Moses to tell the generation that just came out of the Exodus their history and where they're going and why. They are now on the way to do exactly what God said. They had been oppressed for 400 years in Egypt. They had come out of Egypt. They are now on the way. The wickedness of the Amorites was now full. So this is telling that this was told, prophesied a long time before that, 600 years prior to when Moses was giving this to the children of Israel as they were in the wilderness. Now, Abram himself, he would die in peace in an old age before all this would happen. Well, as the night progressed, God sealed the covenant with Abram. Verse 17 explains, look there at verse 17, "And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, and the Cadmonite, the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite." The promise of land is repeated with its border spelled out. And the blue hash mark there on the map is the approximate area of what he's just described. Those are the areas that are being given. It is from the river in Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula all the way in the south to the far north where the Euphrates was, and then all the lands of these various tribes that were descendants from Canaan. Now that includes all of modern Israel, including the Gaza Strip, West Bank, Golan Heights, parts of Lebanon, a whole lot of Jordan, and a major portion of Syria. But the most important part of this covenant is the fact that the smoking oven and the flaming torch, which represented God, passed between the pieces by themselves. Abraham wasn't part of what went through the pieces. This is a unilateral covenant. It is dependent upon God alone and not anything that Abraham will do or will not do. God has made the promise on himself. This land still belongs to descendants of Abram, and though it's considered politically incorrect, it is true. The so-called occupied lands of this area are not those in which the Jews are living. It's the areas in which the non-Hebrews are living. The land belongs to the Jews by God's decree, period. And it will be returned to them. Now, how sure could Abram be that this covenant would be fulfilled? As sure as God is all he claims to be. Why? Because God made the promise himself, based on nothing in Abraham. His own character is at stake in this. God is going to accomplish all of his will in Abram and his descendants. He is still going to keep this covenant. The land will be returned to Israel in the future when Messiah reigns on David's throne. It will all be theirs. Now, the same is true for us. How sure can you be that God is going to keep his promise concerning your salvation? It's same base, isn't it? As sure as God is all He claims to be. It's based on Him. Jesus is going to return for all those that believe in Him. If we die before that, we still have the same promise. He will take us and we'll be with Him forever. He paid the penalty for our sins. We're going to celebrate communion in light of that. This is our assurance. I want to give you a couple moments to pray, to consider and think about where your own life is at, that you might have a proper approach to this. 1 Corinthians 11 warns us to approach this soberly, mindfully, all God has done for us. Praise Him for the things that He's done for you. If there's sin that needs to be confessed, confess it now that you partake properly.